From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers will be back in Tallahassee for a special session to draw up new congressional districts, even though the state constitution specifically bans partisan purposes.
The Florida legislature has to be able to point to these politically neutral factors, politically neutral considerations.
Also this week, Governor DeSantis signs more measures that opponents say further restrict the authority of local governments.
Every year it seems to be ever-increasing attacks on home rule and what local governments are able to do.
We'll also hear the reservations already being voiced about Florida's new elections law, and we'll attend the formal investiture ceremony for the 13th president of Florida A&M University. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The Florida legislature will meet for a special session to redraw congressional maps next week. And as this edition of Capitol Report is going to air, we're still waiting to see if any of those maps might be released in advance. It's the latest of several state legislatures that have redrawn maps ahead of the midterm elections. But Tristan Wood reports the state's top Republicans say Florida's redistricting is not prompted by politics.
Governor Ron DeSantis told the press earlier this month the planned redraw is happening for nonpartisan reasons.
Florida has experienced 10 years worth of population growth in like three. And so if you look, our districts are not fairly apportioned because of that.
He also pointed to another reason he says the state needs new maps. The pending Supreme Court case that is reevaluating whether drawing maps to ensure minority groups get representation is unconstitutional.
But I'm very confident if there's a map that is consistent with what that opinion will eventually say, that that's going to be a map that is going to be upheld going forward.
That's a far cry from months ago, when the Republican Party of Florida Chairman Evan Power said his party could gain up to five more seats under a redraw. Florida's constitution prohibits political gerrymandering. As FSU Election Law Center Director Michael Morley explains, that sets Florida apart from other states that have redistricted.
Unlike states that lack these state constitutional prohibitions on partisan gerrymandering, the Florida legislature has to be able to point to these politically neutral factors, politically neutral considerations.
With that legal situation present, DeSantis and other Republicans pivotal to this process, like Senate President Ben Albritton, have refrained from using partisan language. But that hasn't convinced everyone.
This attempt to rig voting maps to favor one party over another is inherently illegal and unconstitutional.
Abdila Skier with the ACLU of Florida thinks the motivation for this is the same partisan politics that is occurring in other states.
They really opened a Pandora's box. When you get down to it, voters should choose their representatives, not the other way around. And unfortunately, where we are now is that Florida is looking to respond to what's happened in Texas and Missouri and North Carolina and Virginia.
When asked whether the ACLU of Florida will sue over any maps approved next week, Skier says they do not comment on potential or hypothetical litigation. But if they or another group does sue alleging partisan gerrymandering, Morley says it's likely too late for them to have the maps redrawn in court ahead of the midterms due to the Purcell principle. That prevents lower courts from overturning election laws too close to an election to prevent confusion. And a redraw may not even play out in the Republican Party's favor. An analysis from the Civic Data and Research Institute, which is run by a longtime Republican political consultant, thinks a redraw would at most give Republicans one more performing seat, while making them more vulnerable in other seats. It's still unclear what the maps will look like, but drafts will likely be revealed when the Florida legislature starts its special session Tuesday. I'm Tristan Wood.
Governor Ron DeSantis has signed two measures significantly limiting what Florida's cities and counties can do with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, as well as environmental initiatives. WUSF's Douglas Soule reports on the possible effects.
Governor Ron DeSantis says the measures prevent local governments from paying for and being involved in progressive programs.
This is concerning issues that a lot of people have been concerned about for a long time, kind of growing out of the ideology of the last 5 or 6 years that we fought more successfully than anybody.
Tallahassee Commissioner Jeremy Matlow, who's running for mayor, criticizes the move.
Every year it seems to be ever-increasing attacks on home rule and what local governments are able to do. I would say the ones signed yesterday are probably the most egregious that I've seen since I've been elected.
One law will stop Florida cities and counties from paying for, implementing, or promoting DEI programs starting in January. Officials in violation could even be removed from office. DeSantis accuses DEI of being discriminatory, but Matlow calls this another of the governor's culture wars.
At the end of the day, all it really serves to do is have a negative economic impact on our communities. When you start looking at the dollars we bring in from even festivals that they would consider DEI.
Another measure bars governments from policies meant to advance net zero emissions goals. Matlow believes it will slow down city progress to reduce emissions. It takes effect in July. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida's new SAVE Act is the law and is already drawing criticism.
It's just a way to disenfranchise truly millions of people.
People who vote NPA or no party affiliation in Florida are more than a little tough to figure out when it comes to predicting how they'll vote.
NPA is not the same voter, right? There are a lot
of
different
voters. They're not a homogenous
voters.
Group. Yeah.
It appears money from some foreign sources to U.S. universities are definitely gift horses that should be looked in the mouth.
You recruit students or researchers to get access to the university's research and intellectual property.
And we'll attend the investiture ceremony of Florida A&M University's 13th president and hear from some of those who know Marva Johnson best. The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE Act, is a federal voting bill working its way through Congress. It would require proof of citizenship for anyone registering to vote. The Sunshine State recently passed its own version, the Florida SAVE Act. It does a lot, from checking voter rolls to candidate requirements. As WUSF's Megan Bowman reports, multiple pro-voting groups are sounding the alarm on its changes to voter registration.
Among the many things Florida's new SAVE Act does, it will require eligible voters to prove their citizenship to vote, and it could affect millions of Floridians. Susan Magnuson is in her 70s. She says the new law will make it incredibly difficult for seniors.
We don't have a transit system here in Florida. So to be able to get to this office and get these documents and prove your citizenship and all that other baloney, I believe it is a deliberate attempt to limit our voice in Florida.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill earlier this month. He says the law protects the voting registration process.
Our Constitution in the state of Florida says only American citizens are allowed to vote in our elections. And so we need to make sure that that is the law.
The law makes people who need to update or change their registration and those voting for the first time prove their citizenship. It also requires Florida officials to remove voters they believe are not eligible. Almost immediately after the governor signed the bill, pro-voting organizations took action. Carrie McNamara is an attorney for the ACLU of Florida. The group filed suit in federal court. McNamara says with the National SAVE Act percolating, the ACLU saw this coming.
The idea that in order to justify your citizenship, you have to pull together documents from the government that cost money, it's just a way to disenfranchise truly millions of people.
To vote in any federal, state, or local election, you must be 18. There are some other restrictions, but
everyone born in this country gets to vote, and everyone who naturalizes once they come here. gets to vote.
McNamara is concerned eligible voters might not cast a ballot when facing paperwork barriers or confusion over the law. Amy Keith leads the Florida chapter of Common Cause, a nonpartisan organization focused on protecting democracy. It's suing alongside the ACLU.
They want people to be confused and to feel like it's not worth it or to have all these hurdles to jump over.
She says the state's motor vehicles and voter registration databases will be cross-checked, looking for citizenship. If they match, you probably won't run into problems. But if they don't, you'll have to show your papers.
There's also going to be people who there's just errors. There's going to be a whole set of people who have a driver's license who just get the notice anyway because they don't think they're a citizen for whatever reason.
The state's NAACP and the Florida Alliance for Retired Americans also filed a federal lawsuit. Elias Law Group partner Abba Khanna represents them. She says the election law violates the First and 14th Amendments.
As these kinds of provisions historically and traditionally have had an undue burden, particularly on minority voters, older voters, and low-income voters.
During the bill signing, DeSantis said the law is just another way he's strengthening elections. In 2022, he started the Office of Election Crimes and Security to tamp down on voter fraud, especially in, quote, bigger blue areas.
On some of these jurisdictions, they just don't believe in doing voter fraud. That's just the reality.
But Khanna says it's a fictional problem.
This idea that there is rampant, widespread non-citizen voting across the country or in Florida specifically has never been borne out by any evidence in any state.
And Susan Magnuson says she's never seen laws like this.
It just outrages me.
Amy Keith with Common Cause recommends people start getting their documents to be safe. But Elias Law partner Abba Khanna says they shouldn't have to.
There's time for Florida voters to trust the legal process. So hopefully it does not come down to them having to lay out those burdens in order to cast their vote.
The law goes into effect in January. So voting rights groups say nothing will change until after November's midterm elections. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
As long as we're talking about voting, voters with no party affiliation played a key role in a recent upset in a Republican-held state Senate district. But Florida Atlantic University political science professor Kevin Wagner joins the Between the Lines with Derek Ham podcast from State Affairs to explain that having no party affiliation doesn't necessarily mean undecided.
Party, yes, but also NPA voters are not beholden to the party one way or the other, right? So how do you thread the needle?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't have the numbers in front of me. My recollection in 87 was that the Republicans actually outturned out the Democrats, and Gregory still won. And so that suggests that she did. Now, one of two things happened, or maybe both, which is that she pulled some Republican votes or she did disproportionately well among the NPA. Either one is, in likelihood, both are probably relatively true. There's a couple things to think about here, right? One is the Democratic brand in Florida has been really bad. And so you have a portion of the NPA voters are voters that would be, under different circumstances, maybe inclined to register as Democrats, but the brand is so bad in Florida, they just don't want to. That's part of the NPA brand. I always get a little bit wary when people say something like I will get fairly regularly questions about how are independent voters leaning? And the reason that that's such a difficult question to answer, especially if we don't have independent voters in Florida, and then I have to explain the whole right. independent party thing.
Right.
But here's the real fundamental problem with that answer. NPA is not the same voter, right? There are a lot
They're
of different voters.
Not a homogenous group.
Yeah. There are a lot of different voters in NPA for different reasons. For example, right? You have, and this is one type of NPA voter, right? Which is what people think an NPA voter is. I'm a interested political person, and I don't favor one party the other. And I listen to every election cycle, and I listen to what they're promising, and I make a reasoned choice after each election about where I'm going to go, right? That's what people think an NPA voter is. And there are some of those, by the way, not a lot, right? Here's another type of NPA voters. I voted for, Republican or Democrat in every election, that I can remember. But I choose NPA because I like to tell my friends that I'm an independent kind of guy. right. And in fact, here I'll throw some political science on you here. if you actually go into the polling numbers and you ask people what their party affiliation is, we usually do it like this, right? We say, you know, what is your party affiliation? Somebody will say Republican or Democrat. Let's say they say Democrat just for fun, right? We usually follow up with a question about how strongly they identify with it. It can be framed different ways, but the version of it essentially is, do you feel like you're a strong Democrat or, you know, regular Democrat or a weakly identified Democrat, right? And then, you know, they'll give that answer. And then we do the same thing for NPA people, which is if they say, you know, I don't belong to a party or I don't support a party, we usually follow up with a question of, but if you had to choose, you know, where would you choose?
Right.
And we call those leaners sometimes or weakly identifiers, depending on the lingo and which newspaper it's in or who we're talking to. Right.
Sure.
But here's the interesting data point that hopefully the viewers will, if you remember nothing else from this is a good one, right? People who identify as independent or NPA, but lean in one direction or the other, tend to be more predictable partisan voters than people who identify with a party
that
they weakly identify with.
Wow.
Right? Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Which goes back to that base question, which is what are independent NPA voters going to do? And I again ask you, which one are we talking about?
That was Florida Atlantic University political science professor Kevin Wagner on the Between the Lines with Derek Ham podcast from State Affairs. Hear full episodes wherever you get your podcasts. American universities reported more than $5 billion in foreign gifts and contracts last year, according to the U.S. Department of Education. While not all foreign funding is harmful, some gifts could be detrimental to professors and their research. WGCU's Elizabeth Andarji has more about a program at Florida Gulf Coast University to help higher education professionals understand the dangers of international influence.
American universities have always ran on a simple principle: share ideas freely, and science moves faster. FBI Special Agent Charles McGinnis handles private sector outreach for the Bureau's Tampa division, collaborating with institutions to combat national security threats. He says foreign governments have turned that principle into an opening.
So the influence that can happen with foreign actors or foreign nation states, it's often derived by, you know, their needs and what they want from us. But primarily it's in ways like the China talent programs, ways that they want to recruit students or researchers to get access to the university's research and intellectual property for their own use back in their own country.
The Chinese talent programs are often government-sponsored recruitment efforts designed to gain access to cutting-edge information, but it isn't always about national security. McGinnis says the motive can be purely economic.
One of the reasons why a country like China would want to be able to take that technology and that research out and use it in their own country is to get ahead of the market and then develop their own biomedical, you know, use or for some other kind of medicine, and then they put it on the market before the company that has spent all the time in research and developing it has been able to utilize it. So there's a lot of reasons why they want a lot of this technology. Bottom line is they want it, and they're going to a lot of different ways to get it.
Several FGCU faculty and staff in the room said they've already received unsolicited emails offering paid opportunities for research and overseas presentations. McGinnis says those kinds of offers are exactly what to watch out for and laid out red flags.
Number one, fully funded travel to China, fully funded travel to Russia, any kind of contract where they have to engage in a contract and they're going to be paid for services like a salary. I would say those are some of the top red flags. Some of the other more innocuous ones have to do with technology transfer and intellectual property rights.
FGCU allows faculty to work internationally with full disclosure. Any affiliation with a foreign institution, paid or not, must be reported to the university and approved before it begins. That includes participation in foreign talent recruitment programs. The FBI says anyone who receives a suspicious offer can report it at tips.fbi.gov. I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
The Green Swamp is a half million acres of preserved space in the fastest growing part of the state and the birthplace of four major rivers. It's sandwiched between two of the state's largest cities in west central Florida, but few people have heard of it. WUSF Steve Newborn takes us on a three-day hike through Florida's past.
It's day one. We've walked about 5 miles from the put-in site off of Rockridge Road in northern Polk County. We're taking a trail that parallels the Withlacoochee River. We haven't seen another soul here, and the only sound you hear is the wind through the trees.
When you look at a satellite map, this is a giant green space hemmed in on two sides by the spreading grayness of Tampa and Orlando. But the Green Swamp may be a misnomer. Sure, it's wet in the summer and is the source of the Hillsborough, Withlacoochee, Peace, and Oklawaha rivers. But this is the driest part of the year, and water in most places is nowhere to be found. After settling into a campsite on the Florida Trail, we break out an emergency water filter to boil the very brown water we collected from the bottom of a dry lake. It tasted a little gritty as we hunkered down for the night.
It's about 8 in the morning on our second day. The sunlight is peeking through the top of the trees. The Green Swamp is called the hydrological high point of Florida. It's basically a water tower for a good chunk of the state. That's why so many rivers start here. It's an important enough place that this area was preserved years ago. A good chunk of it after Hurricane Donna swept through in 1960 and flooded much of Tampa. And they preserved areas along the Hillsborough River and upstream along the Withlacoochee. Tampa has not been flooded since.
In the 1970s, this was designated an area of critical state concern, which gives it a little more protection from development. Mark Fulkerson is an engineer with the Southwest Florida Water Management District, which oversees much of the area.
I can only imagine if it wasn't protected back in those days and if it had become, you know, condos and Walmarts and subdivisions. Thankfully, there was some foresight back in those early years to do that.
It could have turned out very different. In the 1850s, he says an ambitious plan was hatched to dig a canal from the St. Johns River to Tampa Bay, along where Interstate 4 is now. Another canal would have connected it to a chain of lakes to the north in Lake County. That never happened, but loggers soon came, cutting down centuries-old cypress trees at an abandoned logging camp called Compresco. Given enough time, the swamp recovered.
I'm just so thankful that nothing was ever destroyed through the Green Swamp area, and we're able to preserve it and allow it to function naturally.
More than 30 endangered or threatened species live here. It's become one of the most important points in the Florida Wildlife Corridor. There have been some interesting sightings as well. One is Florida's version of the Yeti, the swamp ape. It probably didn't have good hygiene, so Fulkerson has another name for it.
Skunk ape is the Bigfoot term for Florida. We have had groups from like Discovery Channel go in and look for skunk ape. We've never seen one yet.
But another kind of sighting turned out to be very real, the wild man of the Green Swamp. In 1975, a Taiwanese merchant sailor escaped Tampa General Hospital. He somehow made his way to the swamp where he lived off the land. Hu Tu Mei was arrested 8 months later after the Sumter County Sheriff saw a wisp of smoke from his campfire. Fulkerson says the wild man had an interesting diet.
There's interactions of people seeing him and maybe taking a chicken or something like that, but it was asked of wild man, you know, how'd you survive out there? And he said, well, I ate the little piggies. And they said, little piggies, you know, like the wild hogs? And they said, no. So it turned out to be he lived off armadillos. They called him the little piggies.
The heavens opened up on our last day. The cracked, thirsty ground sopped it up.
So we didn't see too many animals, just a lot of birds, owls, sandhill cranes. Didn't see any coyotes, bears, or even the swamp ape. But what we did see was a beautiful slice of old Florida in the rain.
I'm Steve Newborn in the Green Swamp.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after some contentious debate and even some strong pushback from some quarters, Barbara Johnson was confirmed by the Florida Board of Governors last June as the 13th president of Florida A&M University. Her first day on the job was August 1st, but the ceremonial and celebratory start of her administration came on April 21st of this year during the formal investiture in the school's Lee Hall Auditorium. As the world-famous FAMU Marching 100 sounded a fanfare, a long parade of speakers took the podium to applaud Johnson's ritual ascension, including FAMU Trustees Vice Chair Michael White.
We invested in you to steward a 139-year-old legacy, one born in 1887 of two professors, 15 students, and a faith that refused to be small.
Bethune-Cookman President Albert Mosley pledged undying friendship between the institutions.
FAMU and BCU are family. We always have been, and we always will be.
Except, of course, for the annual football classic between the Wildcats and Rattlers. And then Florida Education Commissioner Anastasios Koumoutsas, a longtime friend and supporter of Johnson, noted that during the first few months of her tenure, she'd already made believers of the powers that be in the state legislature.
Nearly $65.5 million in appropriations during last year's session, which was an increase of $39.4 million over the prior year.
The accolades were nonpartisan. Former state senator and civil rights advocate Arthenia Joyner saying she'd known Johnson since her childhood days.
I watched you grow into the leader you are now, compassionate, disciplined, smart, and unafraid to lift others as you climb.
One of those others being Zayla Bryant, soon to be graduating from FAMU with a business degree. She praised Johnson for helping her realize her dreams.
And thank you for being a true partner on this hill. Someone who understood that the weight of leadership is not carried with just a position, but it is carried in purpose.
Then it was time for Johnson to be garbed in an academic gown of FAMU green. She received a gold neck medallion stamped with the school's coat of arms, and Johnson's predecessor, FAMU's 12th president, Larry Robinson, handed her the wooden and gold mace, a symbol of presidential authority. As Johnson took the podium, she promised that authority would have a core focus.
Everything that this administration does will be judged by one question, and that is, does it help our students succeed?
She also pledged, with perhaps a nod to State Senate President Ben Albritton's priority, a renewed emphasis on an area that's mentioned in the school's title.
Agricultural knowledge, food security, and rural prosperity are matters of national survival.
And finally, gratitude to those who supported her presidency, not only from the start, but also those she managed to win over since taking on the job last summer.
And I carry the faith of every person in this room and every Florida leader who looked at this moment and said, she is the one. FAMU is ready. And the best is yet to come.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Douglas Soule, Megan Bowman, Derek Hamm, Elizabeth Andarji, and Steve Newborn. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.